China Mieville doesn't follow trends. He sets them. His groundbreaking fiction has received critical acclaim and multiple awards. The Hugo Award, the British Science Fiction Award, twice, the Arthur C. Clarke Award, three times, and the World Fantasy Award. Mieville's new novel is called Embassy Town, and it will undoubtedly win him more awards. Among other accolades, Ursula Le Guin describes Embassy Town as a fully achieved work of art. Mieville told Anne Strangechamps that he came up with the original idea for the novel when he was 11 years old.
The initial peg for me was just the idea of aliens or creatures that speak with two voices simultaneously, and that was something that I did come up with when I was about 11. I'm not saying it's original, I'm not saying no one's done it before, but that was when I thought of it. It was original to me. I tend to be very faithful to my own sort of childish ideas, and I, you know, it sometimes takes me a long time for them to percolate through, but that one was sort of sitting there for a quarter of a century until it was eventually cooked and emerged.
Let's get the setting of Embassy Town down first. We're in the far future on a distant planet inhabited by these creatures who are hard to describe. So I'm not even going to try. Maybe you could have a go.
They're sort of deliberately not described conclusively in the book because the book is a first-person narrative written by someone from that world who doesn't feel the need to explain or to describe everything because it's just, you know, it's just where she lives. I recognize in myself very much a slightly kind of nerdy desire to kind of cross all the T's and dot all the I's and have everything explained in a very kind of exact sort of fashion. You know, sometimes I'm very happy to indulge that, but for this particular book, I wanted to do the opposite, and I wanted to not let myself do that, because although you gain something that way, you also lose something. Because the focus of the book is not on the physical specificity of the aliens, and so I didn't want to kind of go down that route too far. So there are references made. We know that they're large. We know they have hooves. We know they have what are called wings, although they can't fly. We know that their cluster of eyes looks a little bit like a kind of coral outcrop, but the composite is left for the reader, I suppose. Mm.
So the Arieke also have two mouths, as you said. This is a biological difference that has profound implications for language and for communication. It's not just that their words are different, but their actual concept of language is completely different.
Yeah, there's two elements to the Ariakine language which are sort of distinct. One is, as you say, that they speak with two voices in harmony, and that was the original peg that we were talking about from when I was a really little kid. And then the second is a conceit about the philosophy of language, which is, you know, in very simple terms, they can't lie, but more specifically, that's because the way they relate the words and the concepts behind the words is fundamentally different. They don't signify in the same way humans signify. It's the sort of coalescing of those two facts that, you know, gives the language its particularity from which the plot is kind of spun out, I suppose, really. Mm. It's kind of a symbolic cliche in English that, you know, someone who's, you know, speaking with a forked tongue, you know, two voices simultaneously is suggestive of lying and mendacity. And I liked the idea of just kind of inverting that in a very simple way, that there's this race that are literally dual-voiced and literally unable to lie. So it was that sort of little, very simple little sort of paradox that kind of spun it out.
Well, we should also try to get across a sense of just how playful the book is also. For instance, you even had to play with typography to figure out how to represent this language spoken with two mouths. So you come up with kind of the linguistic equivalent of a fraction.
It is literally a fraction. When I was writing the book initially and I was typing it, I kind of jerry-rigged something using a little kind of mathematical plug-in for a word processing software, which allows you to do like a kind of denominator and numerator. So you have one line of words above the other line of words. But again, this was, you know, when I was 11 and I was first writing about these, I was scribbling these two different lines of text with a line in between. I have tremendous fidelity to my own obsessions.
Well, I was thinking this is radio, so we can actually play with sound a little bit. We don't have two mouths. I thought we could try. So if you say two halves of an Arieke word, the numerator and the denominator, so to speak, then we'll put them together.
Okay, you're on. Well, so for example, one of the Arieke characters in the novel is called by the humans Serl Tesh Esher. But in their own language, the Serl and the Tesh Esher would be spoken simultaneously.
Serl Tesh Esher.
And this is the effect that they've done with the audiobook. And it's really wonderful for me to hear because I'd been writing all this for a long time, and I'd never actually heard what these things sounded like. And so it was quite thrilling for me to actually hear that.
Before the humans came, we didn't speak so much of certain things. Tesh Esha said again and shucked its wings.
So you can begin to understand why the humans who visit this planet have a hard time communicating with the Arieke. You'd almost need four ears to be able to hear them properly. But there's one woman, your protagonist, Avis, is that how you say her name?
Yeah, Avis Benecho.
Okay, your protagonist, Avis, who comes to know them maybe as well as any human can, so much so that she becomes part of their language. How does that work?
If you've got this race that can only speak things that are literally true, but also have a kind of hazy awareness of things beyond the absolutely quotidian, and they want to express something which they have a kind of hazy sense of, but which they've not been able to express before, what they do is they construct similes. So they say, you know, this is like something else. But the referent for the simile has to have existed for them to be able to conceive of it and to talk about it. So in the case of Avis in the book, a group of these aliens decide that they want to construct a figure of speech to enable them to say, this is like the girl who ate what she was given in darkness. But because there was no such girl, this thought was very kind of hazy and unclear in their head, and they had to actually have Avis go into darkness and eat something and actually have that become a reality in the world before they were then able to say, this situation or that situation is like the girl who ate in darkness. And because there's now actually an embedded reference, they're able to say it clearly and to make a kind of oblique argument of similarity between the two things. And so there are a few people in this world who have the dubious honor of becoming similes.
That scene, it's really kind of sinister early in the book when whatever happens to Avis that turns her into a simile happens. I was going to ask if you could read a little bit of that scene.
Sure. What occurred in that crumbling once dining room wasn't by any means the worst thing I've suffered, or the most painful, or the most disgusting. It was quite bearable. It was, however, the least comprehensible event that had or has ever happened to me. I was surprised by how much that upset me. For a long time, the hosts didn't pay attention to me, but performed precise mimes. They raised their gift wings. They stepped forward and back. I could smell their sweet smell. I was frightened. I'd been prepared. It was imperative for the sake of the simile that I act my part perfectly. They spoke. I understood only the very basics of what I heard, could pick out an occasional word. I listened for the overlapping whisper I'd been told meant she, and when I heard it, I came forward and did what they wanted. I know now to call what I did then disassociating. I watched it all, myself included. I was impatient for it to finish. I felt nothing growing, no special connection between me and the hosts. I was only watching. After I was done, in the youth mall, my friends demanded all details. We were roughnecks, like most Embassy Towner children are. You were with the hosts? That's import, Avi. You swear? Say it like a host? Say it like a host, I said, appropriately solemn for the oath. No way! What did they do? I showed my bruises. I both did and didn't want to talk about it. Eventually, I enjoyed the telling and embellishing of it. It gave me status for days.
That is such a scene. You've managed to make it both creepy and beautiful at the same time, and then also funny at the end.
I'm delighted you think so. It was a lot of fun to... Well, fun is not really the right word, but I'd had that notion of becoming embedded in language a long time, and I was quite careful about the writing of it.
It strikes me that you're working at the limits of thought and the limits of human perception, trying to kind of push past them. And yet there's something deeply paradoxical about this, isn't there? We use words to think, and you're trying to think your way outside of words, which is quite a challenge for a writer.
I think it's a challenge in which you cannot succeed. I think that this notion of pushing beyond is literally unachievable. And an Embassy Town is very much about that. There are quite explicit arguments and debates in Embassy Town between characters on precisely this issue of the notion of the limits of words and the limits of language and so on. You know, one of the great pleasures about writing fiction and reading fiction is not having to come down on one side or the other of these kind of situations. If I were writing a non-fiction piece, I would feel like I had to kind of have some kind of conclusion, some kind of systematic kind of pulling together of the various strands. In fiction, you know, I have the luxury of being able to indulge my kind of intense desire to represent the unrepresentable while knowing full well that's impossible. What you end up hoping is that the process of attempt creates its own kind of thing. It is engaging and is exciting and is powerful. You know, the power of a book doesn't necessarily rest in its success or otherwise at its stated task. The process can be part of the point. And I will say for myself, I don't mind as a reader doing a little bit of work. You don't necessarily want it all the time, but I don't mind books where I don't understand what's going on for some section of the book. As long as I feel like I'm in sort of reasonably safe hands, I feel like the writer is not kind of maliciously playing games with me. If that sense of not understanding is part of the affect that I think is powerful about the book, I'm quite happy to surrender to that. So in and of itself, the criticism which is sometimes leveled against my books, or indeed various other books, I didn't understand what was going on for X number of pages. In and of itself, that to me is not a criticism. You know, now I understand that's not the case for a lot of readers. I understand some readers really find that very frustrating, and fair enough, completely understood, they have every right to read what they want to read. Maybe Embassy Town wouldn't appeal to them. But speaking for myself as a reader, I get an immense pleasure out of reading a book where for the first 30 or 40 pages or even more, I really don't understand what's happening, but I feel completely compelled anyway, and I feel like the writer is pulling me through.
China Mieville is the author of Embassy Town. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Mieville said he doesn't mind reading novels where he doesn't always understand what's going on. Do you feel the same way? Or do you get frustrated and abandon the book? You can share your thoughts by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Always nice to hear from you.